thank you very much to the organizers for inviting me to talk here. It's a great honor to be here today. Thanks to my the non-cooperation of my laptop, I'm going to give a blackboard talk, but that might be a blessing in disguise for you, as it'll force me to go slower and perhaps be more understandable. What I'm going to be talking about is measure-valued processes that arise in stochastic networks. As we all know, there's been a lot of work on measure-valued processes arising from in genetics models and measure-valued processes, branching processes. But I feel that the recent work on measure-valued processes arising in stochastic networks, the measure-valued processes seem to have a slightly different mathematical features that might make their analysis interesting. So the idea is just to present two examples of stochastic networks and the measure-valued processes that arise from them, and to show sort of what is the nature of perhaps some of the new methods that are needed for their analysis. So my talk is going to consist of three sections. Let's see if I have time. One is to sort of remind people who aren't that familiar, perhaps, or just of sort of what happens in the case when a stochastic network can just be have a simple finite dimensional representation. So a little brief recap of that, and then I will talk particularly about one particular stochastic network, which is a sort of what I will call an EDF model. EDF standing for a certain scheduling discipline. And then if I have more time, I will talk about a perhaps even more interesting model, which is a many-server model, okay? And these two require measure-value representation and give rise to measure-value processes. So let's just take the most simple example of a queuing network where you have a single station coming in, okay, and your server is serving at rate 1, and you have some arrival process here, which is given by some renewal process. So the arrival is a renewal. So let's say that you have customers, cumulative amount of customers that are coming in at time 0 to t, being denoted by an of t. And each of them bring iid independent work. There's a sequence, iid sequence vij, vi's, let's say in an n system, because I'm going to, n stands for the nth system, because I'm going to scale ultimately in a fashion that I will explain in a little while. But so just, you can ignore the n for the moment. So AT is a cumulative stochastic process which tells you how many customers have arrived by 0 to T. And each customer that arrives will have a certain work that is amount of VIN. And VIs are all distributed from some common distribution F. Okay? So for instance, what does one sample path of this look like? Of the path, let's look at V. I'm going to look now at the sum of these being V, so the total work that comes into the system, okay, Vn, An of T, Vn, now cap Vn is just the sum of these from I equals 1 to n. Vn of An of T is just going to be your simple, so with these being the inter-arrival times of the customers here, and this being, okay, with the n superscripts. So just one path is just a simple non-decreasing process of the sort, pure jump process. And so what we're interested in is to see, okay, what is going to be the server. So work is coming in at that rate, and the server is just serving at a simple rate 1. Okay. So then if you define what is called the net put process, what I'm interested in is what is the content of the queue at any time. Okay, how much work is there that's waiting to be served at any time? That's the quantity that one is interested in. Then one knows that if this is never empty, right, this is just simply, this is an absolutely trivial process to analyze, right? It's just Vn, An of T minus T, right? That's all. But of course, this is not, this is really, this is what's called a net put process, but the actual workload process, The workload refers to the amount of work in the queue that hasn't, that's waiting to be served. Is not quite this, because you could have times when the queue is empty, in which case, even if this has a potential to serve at rate 1, it wasn't actually depleting anything at that time. So you have to add to this the amount of time that the server was idle in the period 0 to t. Okay? It turns out that this is, so what you want to do is the workload process at time t is going to be this net put process. Let me call it NN of t, or net put. Plus some process, which is the idle time, the amount of time that the process was idle. So what do we know about this process? IN of t is non-decreasing because it's the cumulative amount of time that it was idle. And we also know that IN of t can increase only when this is zero, right? Because it's telling you how much. So what you have is WN of t DIN of t is equal to zero. Okay? So even in this simple model, it's just one of the general themes is going to be about how queuing networks introduce discontinuities and transitions. You can see that in this process, even though it's a simple process to analyze, at zero, the transition rate changes for this process, right? Because at, when the queue is at zero, then you have a sort of different rate at which. So a characterization of this kind of process, when you have an input, so it's well known, I have to introduce now what's called the Skorokhod map on 0 infinity, or the reflection map. The reflection map associates to every, it could be a right continuous with left limits trajectory in D, okay, a function C, or a pair, I'll say, C eta, such that C eta is greater than or equal to 0. So psi is anything that's lying in RD, taking values in R. But I want to, from something that's living in R, create a process that takes value only in R plus. Okay? So in order to do that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my psi of t and add something, eta of t. Okay? And this eta of t should satisfy exactly what we want. Eta of t represents really this idle time process. Okay? So you can ask this general formulation for any input trajectory psi. Do you have this? And this is well known to exist. And in fact, so this was, this formulation arose in early 60s by Skorokhod, who was actually studying stochastic differential equations with reflection at zero. Okay? And so there is a unique mapping. So existence and uniqueness was proved by Skorokhod. And in fact, there's an explicit formula. You can write eta t. Of course, phi is written in terms of eta, so it's enough to just write any one. Phi can be written explicitly as sup okay. So maybe it's worth to just draw a picture to tell you what this mapping is doing. So suppose I have a trajectory psi. Then my C is going to follow this as long as I'm above zero. Okay? And at this point, because my trajectory is going low, my eta is going to push up to here. But over here now my psi is again, my psi over here is, has it, let's say if it was differentiable, has a derivative such that it's going to make me stay non-negative. So it'll follow this and then go like this. So it's not a reflection of this process, even though it's called a reflected process. It's actually a constrained version of this process. Okay, so the mapping from, this is my phi. Okay, so you have a mapping from psi to phi, And that's called the scorecard mapping. And I'll denote it by gamma 0 because it's on 0. So, okay, so in particular, if you had, the reason why sometimes this is called a reflection map is if you put a Brownian motion here, you get a reflected Brownian motion here, if you define it this way. And that has the same distribution as reflected Brownian motion. That is, it has the same distribution as this. Oh, it's related. Okay. So that's the reason why it has this sort of terminology of calling it reflected, though if you think of it in terms of the map, it's better to call it a constrained process. Okay, it's a constrained version of the process. So what we have is, you can see from this mapping, I mean from this explicit formula, that this mapping is continuous on path space with respect to either the scorecard topology or the uniform on compact topology. Okay. So you have a nice continuous mapping. This process itself, if you sort of scale it in an appropriate fashion, then I'll tell you, okay, is going to converge to a Brownian motion. And Wn of t is then just, so what we've concluded from this is that we can write Wn of t, the workload process, as simply this mapping applied to the net put process. Okay? So if this workload was always non-negative, then it's essentially just this, the net put process. Now, what is the use of sort of abstracting this in terms of a map? The useful thing is that really what this does is reduces the study of this to a much simpler object, which is the study of this, which has nice scaling properties. And if you scale this in a sort of functional central limit way, then you know this goes to Brownian motion. This will go to reflected Brownian motion. So really, and what you have nice continuous properties. So if you know this process goes to something, then you just use continuous mapping. So what you've really done is you've abstracted this whole everything into the properties of this map. So once you understand the properties of this map, then you have a simpler process to analyze, which doesn't have any of these constraints that arise in queuing networks. Okay? Now, suppose you had the same process, but now instead, I mean, same single station network, but now instead you had a finite buffer. So a small variation is, suppose you had a finite buffer. Then you might ask, well, how do I write what happens? So then, of course, the equations that I would have to write, I would have to sort of add another term here. It becomes a little more complicated. Not much more, but a little more. But it turns out that now you can look at a scorecard map again. So I have the same net put process, and my claim is that I can still write my workload process in this case as another mapping, and I'll explain what this mapping is in a minute, applied to the net put process. Okay? Now this is the scorecard map on 0A. And here's where I can make use of being on the blackboard. So we have a scorecard map on 0A. It's really asking for the same thing. But now I have two processes, both of them increasing. So what is the idea? What happens in the net put process? At this point, I actually have to add a process that tells me that I have to keep track of the amount of stuff that I lose because of a finite buffer.
What is a buffer?
You can just think of a buffer as a level beyond which, if there's any stuff over here, I lose it. Okay, that's what I mean by a finite buffer. So my workload can never be more than the value A. Okay? So think of work coming into this, and anything that exceeds A, every time I exceed A, I lose all the work that I'm at A. So really this process eta, right now you have a certain amount, so to the net put process I have to add some amount because of the idling, but then I also have to subtract some amount, which is the amount that was lost. Okay? So if you want to think in the Brownian world, all these really correspond to local times at 0 and local times at A. okay? But they come up very naturally in a queuing network, I think, because they tell you the sort of the amount that's lost from the buffer, and this tells you the amount of time it's idle. So it actually has a physical interpretation. So going back to here, the scorecard map on 0A, you have two processes, and then you have again, of course, this has to satisfy this, but in addition, you also have you have another what's called a complementarity condition where I can only lose stuff if my process is at A. If it's below, I can't lose stuff. So this is just to say that. Okay, now the score, so now you can ask, is there a process? So given any psi, can I find A to 0, A to A such that this exists, etc. And in this, pardon? Yes, sorry, thank you. I had to change this too. Precisely. For every t, right? This should hold. This is 0 to infinity. Right? Okay. Thanks. So you can ask a more general question of scorecard problems in more general domains with different directions. So if you think of this, you can think of this as 0a being a domain and you're allowing directions to push this way and push that way. Okay, this is just a one-dimensional problem. But you can ask for a more general domain with directions of constraint and saying, can I push in a certain way and keep things inside? And those things sort of arise when you look at networks of buffers. And they're very interesting questions about existence and uniqueness that come up, but I'm going to be talking about just the single station today. And rather than talk about the networks, I'm going to talk about more complicated processes, more scheduling disciplines, which require measure-value representations. So, okay, so this is very simple. So for this, there's no explicit formula. There was no known explicit formula for gamma 0a, like we had in the however, sort of using a more abstract technique, and of course in this case it's sort of simpler, but you can prove, Tanaka proved for more convex to bounded convex domains with normal directions that you always have a solution to the scorecard problem. So it didn't really give an explicit solution, but it constructed, it showed existence and uniqueness. Okay. Not only do you know that it exists and is unique, but you also know it's continuous, again, with respect to the same topology on path space. And so again, you can use, once you have convergence of the network processes you have. So now let me talk about what kind of scaling you're interested in. You're usually, so scaling that you're typically interested in is that you look at sort of the, I can look at this under the condition, so I'm going to assume in what is called heavy traffic. Heavy traffic roughly means I can talk about rho n as being the mean of this process, okay, and this thing is 1. So if rho n goes to 1, as n goes to infinity, then I know that the fluid, the strong law of large numbers, the functional strong law of large numbers of the network process is just going to be 0, or it's negative. Okay? So maybe I should define this more carefully, but I will in a minute. So let's assume that, so let me explain what heavy traffic is for those who. And lambda n is just the mean of the arrival process. 1 over mu n is the mean of this, of each of these vi's, this f. Okay, has mean 1 over mu n. So if you have this in particular, rho n is going to 1. Okay, which means if you take ANNP and divide by N minus P, this thing is going to zero, right? It's just a strong law of large numbers, functional strong law. So it's going to the zero process. And therefore, if you apply the mapping to it, the Skorka mapping is going to remain zero. So therefore, my centering in the central limit theorem is zero. And so that's why I just have WNP over root N. Okay? If I look at this, because of scaling homogeneity properties of the Skorokhod map, I can write this as basically I can take it inside. So let me define all these quantities which are sort of the central limit theorems, scalings with hats. Okay, so I can just write this as okay? And it's a well-known renewal theorem that this thing goes to a Brownian motion with drift minus gamma. It's just a well-known theorem because it's a renewal process. And so therefore you have Wn converges weakly to W star, which is a reflected Brownian motion with drift minus gamma. Okay, so this is really what you know in the finite dimension. I mean, this is a really simple example, but this is sort of what mappings help you do in the finite dimensional case. So now if you want to ask various questions about the workload process, you know you can approximate it for rho n that's high, and that's the regime you're interested in because you're interested in what happens when the system is over close to instability, right? So you're interested in what happens. You have a reflected Brownian motion drift minus gamma. And this is true for, I didn't tell you what order the scheduler is choosing customers from here. It doesn't matter. As long as whenever there are packets here he's serving, it's called a non-idling discipline, which is captured by this condition. So non-idling, that is, the server doesn't idle when there's work to do. Okay, so as long as that's the case, you will get this. Okay, so that's as far as the finite dimensional model goes. That's something to keep in mind, that the workload process always just goes to a reflected Brownian motion. Now I'm going to consider the same arrival and workload processes. So you have the same process coming in, but now I'm going to have what's called the earliest deadline first scheduler. So now in many practical systems, people are interested in packets come with deadlines. Okay, and you have to process these packets by a certain time. So they come with deadlines, and if you don't process them by that time, there's no point in having that packet. So this is, you know, video streaming video, whatever. There are many, many applications. But so each process, you, in addition to the inter-arrivals and the service times, you also have what each thing's coming with, what we call, I'll call a lead time, tau in. So each customer comes with a lead time, which is distributed, okay, which has its, will be drawn from a certain distribution G. And I'll explain exactly what the scaling is in a minute for the distribution G. Okay. So let me call, since it's a lead time, let me just call it L. Now, what do I, so let me tell you what this discipline does. So let's say that there are a bunch of packets here, right, in the queue waiting. And here's my server, right? And I have to decide which of these I'm going to. So I'm going to choose the packet that has the most imminent lead time. Okay, so that means I have to choose the one that has the deadline that's closest. Okay, so at any given time, if another packet, I'm processing this, and if another packet comes in here, I stop processing this and I move on to this. So that's called a preemptive. Okay, So I will be more precise about this, but this is called the earliest deadline first discipline. And so you have to ask, what is a reasonable scaling of the lead times in this case, and what is the goal here? It's not just here, you don't just want to know what the workload process is, but the performance measure of interest is what fraction of the people met their deadlines. So you need to sort of keep in mind the deadline profile of all the customers in the system in order to be able to calculate what quantity met their deadlines. Okay? So how do I represent this system? It's clear that the Markovian representation of the system cannot be finite dimensional when you have a general lead time distribution. But we know from this theorem that since this process is work conserving, that we know that the total workload just goes to an RBM. Okay? So if you know that the total workload goes to an RBM, then you know in the end system that the delay is of order root n. Okay, this may not be directly clear to you, but from the scaling, if you think about it a little bit, you'll see that in the average delay in the end system will be root n. So a natural scaling for this, if you have lead times that are, you know, less than root n, no one's going to be able to make it. Right? So you need to see what is the distribution of these processes, of the lead time distribution is assumed to be of the form that so this is some general distribution. But this is the natural scaling because this is of order root n. So I say, well, this is going to be a gy. Okay, so a measure-valued representation of this process is as follows. Let this be 0. I'm going to consider a measure, nu n, vn, okay, which at any time, I'll explain what this is. So this is going to be my arrival work measure, or arrived work measure. So I need to keep track of what is the deadline of each of these customers and how much work they came with at any time. Okay? So it's, but this is going to be, so suppose my arrival distribution I can have mu 0 n is this. So what is this? This is telling me that one customer came with lead time this, another customer came with lead time this, so on and so forth. Of course, if you want, you can even allow people to come late before they, but most of the time you'll have an arriving workload which is to the right. Okay? And what I'm going to see, your lead time, so these are sort of your deadlines that you come in with, and the lead time is equal to t minus your deadline. Okay. Yeah. Very little, and I'm going to come to it. And I mean, for now, actually, you can get rid of this as well, but you assume that, let's say, it has an upper bound, but that's just for technical reasons. That is, you know, that it's supported on 0 y star. But it's not needed for much of the assumptions. Okay. So you have a lead time that is, so how much time will I become late? That's what the lead time is. Okay. So, pardon? Sorry? Deadline minus T, yeah, I know. That's why I raised it. It wasn't looking right to me. Thank you. Okay, so lead time at time T, right? So really your lead times, now nu T of N is the measure that keeps track of this lead time process, which is nothing but this just shifted to the right, left by T. Okay? So I'll just say that this is T minus T of, so it's just somehow convenient to talk about this measure. Okay. So nothing changes. This height is the amount of work each of these things came in, and this is the deadline. So this is the work, and this is the deadline. This doesn't keep track of when they came in, right? It's just the work and the deadline. Okay. And so now these are the lead times at time t and the work. So I'll have another one. Okay? And now I can define another workload measure. It's a measure valued process which at time b tells me the amount of work at time t that has deadline, has lead time, sorry, in the set B. Right, for any Borel set, I can see what is the amount of work that at any time has measured set B. And what we wanted, so the EDF discipline is such that if there is work to the left of some point, then it cannot be giving any service to the right of that point. Right? As long as there's some work to the left, then I must be serving things to the left. Okay. So therefore, this concept turns out to be very useful in analyzing this. So the frontier is the largest lead time at time t of any customer, whether he's still in the system or not, who has received service. So let's say you have the workload measure and you have this the arrived work measure. You look at this and you say, well, let me see all of these arrows, which of them have actually diminished a little bit, right? And I go to the rightmost of those arrows, and I say, that's my frontier, right? Because to the right of the frontier, my workload measure is exactly as my arrival measure. There's no change. That's the way the frontier is defined. It's important to understand the frontier, so if it's not clear, ask me. Yeah. You see, this is where I had several pictures to denote this better. But okay, let me just quickly draw a picture of two. Okay, at time t equals 0, you had this. At time t equals 1, right, I would have served this guy a little bit. So the orange part is what's been served, and this lead time just moves to the left. But the arrow is exactly the same as that, right? So at this point, the frontier is this. This is my frontier. But at t equals 2, suppose I have another arrival here in front of this guy. And then I start serving this person at t equals 3. So even though I'm serving this person currently, this is my frontier. Okay? And so
when an arrow disappears, that's still included?
That's still included. So whether the customer, as I said it, I didn't write it, but whether the customer is in service or not. So that's why I said it's good to look at this, the original process, and see which of these have had arrows which were diminished. And then look at the rightmost of those, and you look at what lead time that is. Okay? But of course, in this process itself, none of the arrows would be diminished, right? But you have to see which got diminished in the work. Okay. Then some observations. So, of course, where am I going here? The goal is to find what is the limiting lead time distribution in the heavy traffic limit. Okay. So now you might ask a natural question, which is in the EDF discipline, there are two ways. What do you do when someone becomes late? What do you do when these arrows reach 0 and there's still something there. Do you continue to work on them or do you chuck them out? Okay. So I'm going to call, when you continue to work on them, I'll call it the standard EDF. Because there might be cases when it's a soft deadline. It's not like, you know, you just try to get as many as possible done, but, you know. And the other, which you allow, you, they leave when they get to zero, then in that time the lead times can also be thought of as sort of a patience of the customer. And they just leave. They renege. So that's called REDF. Okay? Now for, I should mention, much of this work is joint with Lukasz Krug, John Lehoski, and Steve Shree. So some observation is the following, that for any y greater than the frontier, the workload measure to the right of that is exactly equal to the arrival measure. Because I haven't touched that part, okay? Now, another fact is I want to try and get some hold of the workload measure in terms of this measure. Again, using the sort of same idea, is there some nice mapping that will take? So let's look at this mapping. Before I do that, let me call let IN of t be the idle time process, which we know we can get, remember, from the original scorecard MAC for the whole workload. It was the local time at zero that you get for this process. Okay. Now, let's see how we would try to express this workload measure in terms of the original workload measure. Well, what is the... what is the amount of work that I could spend on this? What's the maximum amount of work I could spend on this? Is all my time minus the amount of time I was idle. I already know how much time I was idle, right? Irrespective, because we know what the idle thing is just from the overall scorecard map. Okay, so is this clear? I could have done this, but maybe not. Maybe I spent some time serving people to the right of Y. Right? I could have, so what is the amount of, if I had all the time, because the EDF discipline always tends to serve on the left, if I had never served to the right of Y, then this would be exactly it. But then I have to do a correction, just like we did in the single map where we did a correction for idleness. Now I have to do a correction for how much time I might have spent serving people to the right. And so that means by the EDF discipline, I could only be serving things to the right if this is zero, right? So this is at time t. Right, I could only be serving things to the left if this was zero. So again, you get a scorecard map type of thing. Okay. Maybe the exact, this, there's a Y plus T minus S because I'm looking at the thing at S. And so these are all of the things that arrived by S that would have lead time less than Y at time T. Okay. So what is this? This is just almost like the negative of this, which is exactly what we had for the scorecard map. So the point is that whatever I'm adding here, you don't have to see exactly what this is, but whatever I'm adding here is a process that will increase only if this is zero. Okay, so it gives me exactly what I want. So So now I have a mapping from measure-valued processes to measure-valued processes. It again has nice properties. Okay? You do need to do some work to show what class of processes the mapping is acting on, etc. But so another observation is that, so now we have this nice map, but we need to understand another thing, which is so these are now, all these hats are going to be scaled in the functional central limit kind of way. This goes to zero. And let me just tell you why this should be true without actually explaining it. Okay. Remember how the EDF, you can think, what is this? All the service is being given to stuff that was between minus infinity and FNT. So you can think of this as sort of a queue in itself with rate 1 being served to this. Okay. And what's the arrival to this? The arrival is less than the total arrival, because there's some arrivals that are coming to the right of this. So this is like a subcritical queue, so it's going to have a, it's going to be unstable, it has a drift that's negative, and so you are actually underloaded in this queue. So rather than being in a critical, rather than getting reflected Brownian motion, it will just get zero. Okay, that's the intuition behind this. You have to do work to show this. The other thing you can show is that this measure, and this is easy to explain why, goes to the following quantity. Okay, why is this? Let's try to see this. So if you want to try and look at the number of, so if you had scaled lead time, so let's, x at time t, when must the customer have arrived, right? The customer must have arrived t minus x, or time units s earlier. We don't know what that S is, but at that time when it arrived, what was its lead time? Is that clear? I mean, it just arrived S units earlier, so its lead time must have been X plus S, because the lead time is just diminishing linearly with time. And therefore, the density of this is just g prime x plus s. Let's assume the density exists. This is just a heuristic. I don't need the density to exist for. Right? So the g prime of x plus s is the number of customers that would have come in this, because that was the lead time distribution. So, but now I integrate over all possible s. And that's simply 1 minus gx. So that's the density of customers that have scaled lead time x at time t, and so then I integrate this if I want y to infinity. Okay, so that's the heuristic behind that. But now we basically have the theorem in this case. So what we know, what this does, we know that what's to the left of this is zero. So everything is to the right of the frontier. But if it's right of the frontier, then it's exactly the same as the arrival. So the only thing we know to know is what is the total mass to the right of the frontier. Right? But we know the total mass, because what is the total mass? Okay. Remember that we know we have a reflected Brownian motion. So we know that W hat n of R, which is the total workload.
I have to admit I forgot what the hat
is. Yeah, hat is just the central limit scaled, and that is 1 over root n of This is just kidding. Okay? So this root NB is the only sort of non-trivial thing, otherwise it's the usual central limit theory. So we know this goes to W hat, but we know that all of this lies to the left. So, I mean to the right of the frontier, because there's nothing to the left. So if you look at this function, 1 minus g of x is this. Okay, this is 1. If you look at this, what I need to do is, I need to just integrate. I want to know where my frontier is going. Once I know where my frontier is going, I'm done, right? Everything is okay, because to the right of the frontier, I know. But to find the frontier, I need to just work back from this way till the area under this curve is W hat. I don't know if that's clear why. Because the point is, you know that everything to the right of this frontier is the entire mass, and the entire mass is this. And so, and you know that this is going to this function. So I just keep integrating back till I reach this point, and I know that this is exactly my limiting frontier. So this is in fact H inverse of W hat of t. So what I have in effect then, I know that my W hat is simply converges to V hat of n times y max, where f hat t, this is a theorem. W hat was just your Brownian motion. So this is our whole lead time profile. So let's see why this is true. W hat n of y infinity is the same as w hat n, almost, right? We're taking limits of f hat n infinity. Y max f hat infinity, right? This is the same. I can replace this by, so let's, this can be the same as y max. Pardon? Yeah, h was this integral that I defined earlier. Okay. But to the right of that, it's exactly this, and this goes to this. So, sorry, this is the same as this, which should be written. This goes to, I already said what it goes to, so it's actually sort of h of this. Right. Okay. So it looks sort of, really the details are not as important as to say that what are we using. The general tools are that you sort of use a similar mapping on measure-valued processes. And what you get in the end is that the whole random measure, in fact, converges to something that is determined by a one-dimensional process. So in this process, this infinite-dimensional process, is actually, there's some state, there's some collapse in the sense that in dimensions. It's a sort of degeneracy in the limit that you can represent this infinite dimensional process in the limit in terms of really just a deterministic function of a random diffusion, reflected diffusion, in fact. So now I'll just make some comments on really the R, so this sort of mapping representation was not used in the original paper which got this result. But because we were looking at the REDF case, I'll just mention some of the extra subtleties and tell you how a similar mapping is used over here and stop with that. In the REDF case, there are several subtleties. One, even the whole workload process is not known a priori. You might think, hey, why not? This thing is work conserving. Why is it not just some reflection, double reflection map? The question is, what is the upper end if it is a double reflection map? I don't know. And the reason is because what is lost depends on the entire measure, right? because the lead time measure determines what's reneging. So therefore, you cannot know the workload process, even the entire workload process, not just the workload measure press process, you know. Just the entire one-dimensional workload process is not known. You have to actually do a measure-valued analysis. But it turns out that what we do is we define another mapping, which I'm not going to. We show that we couple this with another process, which is given by a certain measure-valued. So this was the workload measure when you didn't renege. This is in the standard EDF system. This is the measure process. And you define another process. And it turns out that using this mapping, this is a nice, well-defined mapping, and you can couple this very easily with this. And you can find the limit of this. And it led, by applying this to the particular case when the entire measure is R, it led to an explicit formula for the double map. That was sort of a side, which I can write down for anyone who's interested. Okay. But the point is that there is this map. Now, using that, I will tell you what it turns out to be, that the process looks very much like this process, except that instead of truncating the measure here, instead of the front, you can define a similar frontier and etc. The same crushing lemma goes through, everything else goes through, though you have to prove it in very different ways. But what changes here is this limit, right? So you still have the same representation as this. So the FRT becomes this. Okay, so it's nice that that's preserved. But now, W hat R of T, any guesses for what this is? No. It's a one-dimensional process because it's the workload process. So it's just the total workload. It's the total workload in the process. So we know that the total workload, if you think about this, in the reneging system, there is no lateness, right? Because every time, you can never have measure to the left of zero, because every time they come to zero, they leave. Okay, so you know that you can never get to the left of zero. Now, I think in the original process, when do you get to the left of zero? You get to the left of zero if the frontier is to the left of zero, right? And when is the frontier to the left of zero? When W hat R of T is greater than H of zero. So it turns out that this is a doubly reflected Brownian motion on zero, H of zero. And the reason why this is interesting from a practical point of view is that we saw that this is a more efficient system, the REDF, in a sense, if you could. But you don't want to keep track of everybody's lead time and then evict them at the time when they come to zero. But it tells you that you can do a certain admission control policy by just looking at the total workload in the system. And you don't admit a person when they come in if the workload is above H0. And using all these measure value processes and everything, you can come up with an admission control policy, which is likely to get you a very simple one, which will get you gains over. So of course, to quantify those gains, you have to analyze what exactly is the rate of rejection, right? That's what you have to compare, the rate of number of people that you're rejecting in the admission control as opposed to the number of people who became late in the original system. And you can show that this is less, the steady state distribution of that. So just to conclude, I'm not going to get to the many server model clearly, but I would just make a comment that a similar diffusion measure value process diffusion limit here actually has an infinite dimensional, a truly infinite dimensional measure valued limit, as opposed to, you know, one that's governed by a one dimensional process. And the corresponding sort of process of interest here is given by sort of a non-Markovian SDE, which is sort of interesting to analyze. So and I'll stop here.